Why stand still when you can run headfirst into a wall? You're listening to the Jocular Pugilists. Hey everybody, sorry I wasn't around last week. I had a pretty big loss. And so Tomas was nice enough to kind of pick up the slack. This week, he's actually out of town. So we're going to do sort of the same thing we did last week. I'm going to play you one of my old episodes from my previous podcast. It's called Seated at the Writer's Table. This is an interview I did with Larry Wilson, who was the writer for Beetlejuice. So it was a really fun conversation. I hope you like it. Very different from what Tomas and I do. Anyway, we will be back next week with a new episode, so we'll see you then.
The book is not the important part. The book is the delivery system. The important part is the story and the talent.
I like to work on more than one project at a time because it keeps me ever from getting blocked.
The novel to me is a demonstration of emotional and psychological truths. It's not an intellectual exercise.
Seated at the Writer's Table is all about the craft and business of writing. You can support the show and our community of writers by liking us on Facebook, rating and commenting on the show on iTunes, and visiting seatedatthewriterstable.com. Now, please take your seat at the Writer's Table with our host, Phil Giangrande.
Hey guys, and welcome to a special edition of Seated at the Writer's Table. This week, I have on the co-writer and producer of Beetlejuice, the movie, and also he was a consultant on the TV show, Larry Wilson.
He's also got a new project that we're going to talk about called Cindy, and I'm really, really looking forward to everybody hearing about this project because it's a very cool idea. You directed it, you produced it, and you wrote it.
Co-wrote it.
It's a great project, so we're going to get into all of that, but thank you for being on the show.
I'm happy to be here.
Let's get right into your characters because you write some of the most unique characters, of course, that have ever been on the screen, obviously Beetlejuice being one of them. Where do you get your ideas for your characters?
They're very organic. I'd be hard-pressed to say like a single source, but I grew up loving, you know, violent Tex Avery cartoons. silent comedy and slapstick comedy and horror movies and horror comics and all that kind of synthesized, I think. And I've written some straight horror. I wrote for Tales from the Crypt for 5-6 years. But most of the stuff I've done, they're characters that have a sinister, diabolical side to them, perhaps, but have a comedic edge. And Beetlejuice, particularly, was a character that I co-wrote it with Michael McDowell, my late partner. And that character emerged on the page, definitely.
Okay.
We did a very good outline of that character. But if I'm being really honest about Beetlejuice, Michael Keaton took what we had done, and I would say that 75% of his performance in Beetlejuice is improvisation. And he took the outline of what we gave him and the inspiration of what we gave him and just ran with it. And not to get into anecdotes too soon, but the movie he was not available because of scheduling issues until almost the last of the shoot. So we had basically made Beetlejuice without seeing Beetlejuice. and he came, well, the first time I saw him give the performance, it was a costume and makeup test. And we were sitting in a screening room and he was in that, you know, that Beetlejuice costume and makeup. Mm-hmm. And he just started riffing and we were like, oh, thank you, God, because it just, that character just poured out of him. So my inspirations are varied and they, in that weird way that happens when you write all these influences process, and they come, you know, and hopefully you have a voice. And mm-hmm. I do believe I have a voice, and it always kind of involves dark and light, unless I'm very specifically going for one or the other.
Right. Yeah. Which brings me to ask you, is that part of your personality? Like, do you believe you're...
Yeah. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
So
yeah.
Do you, how much of yourself are you putting into these characters?
People would find it weird to say that something like Beetlejuice is autobiographical, but there's a lot of me in it and a lot of my sensibility. And my writing partner on The Addams Family, Caroline Thompson, who wrote Edward Scissorhands and Nightmare Before Christmas, a brilliant writer, she described me once as Tom Sawyer on acid. And that kind of that kind of works,
yeah,
too. Yeah. So, I mean, it's definitely part of me. I try not to dwell in the dark. That's hard sometimes, right? Mm-hmm. You read the news. But I try to balance the two, and it's definitely a part of me also. Yeah.
Now, when you write a feature film like that, how often are you allowed to be part of the actual production? I mean, you were there when he was doing his thing, and frankly, if you weren't happy with his interpretation, how much can you speak out and sort of?
I've told people the one mistake I've made in my career is that I assumed that it would all kind of go like Beetlejuice went. You know, I mean, sure. Because it was a very hard development process. There were a lot of obstacles along the way. But once David Geffen became truly involved as the producer and Tim Burton signed on, it was absolute lightning in the bottle. And I was welcome on the set and certainly welcome as an observer. But at that point, it becomes the director's job, and you, by the decorum of it, step back a little bit. But I was there for the process, and it wasn't a problem. The Addams Family, it was the opposite situation. It got to a point where I was not welcome on the set. It just depends.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And will you get show notes from the studio while they're filming where they say, hey, can you tweak this? Can you do that?
That does happen. Yes. It happens all along the way, to the good and sometimes to the not so good. The ones that are working, usually the notes fall off when you're actually shooting. But I've been in situations where you're getting notes every day. I co-wrote and co-produced a movie called The Little Vampire, where basically every night we were rewriting because of some catastrophe that had happened on the set that day, and we were having to, you know, like figure out how do we fix this, and how do we shoot tomorrow? So
do you have an example? Like, what's an example of a catastrophe that could make you need to rewrite?
Let's say this about that particular project. It was a very problematic production with a very problematic director, perhaps. I'll say that there. I just gave it all away. I just totally...
anybody who goes on IMDb now.
Yeah. We'll just be able to figure that one out. But people go... But it was things like we shot in Edinburgh, Scotland, because of tax incentives.
Right.
And we had a cast of children, and someone had not sorted out the fact that it's daylight in Edinburgh at the time we were shooting until like 3 a.m. And we were with kids who by contract and by their own needs needed to go to sleep. And we were doing night shoots. And so everything got turned upside down because of, you know, just the sunlight. I mean, and it all started from there, and things started dragging along. And then the first day we were going to use our stuntmen, they'd been sitting, waiting, and there had been delays. And there was a guy on a catapult, you know, doing a vampire like flying into the air sequence, and the catapult was too strong, and he flew up and he hit the lights and he hurt himself and he came down, and we couldn't use what we had, and we were faced with the next day with a stuntman who was, you know, injured. And so it became my job to like kind of figure out, okay, well, what can we shoot the next day while we're sorting out this problem? And it was as stressful a situation as I've ever been in. But I suppose, you know, I learned from it. And now as we'll talk about Cindy, I'm really embracing this DIY, this do-it-yourself ethic. boy, you better be able to solve problems on the fly and kind of be flexible about what you're doing, or you'll never get it done.
That's a very good point, because you're really in control of everything. And
yes,
that's got to be overwhelming to a sense. I mean, does that, how does something like that come about? Do you write it first and then just decide, listen, I'm the only person who can turn this into what I want it to be? Is it a budget issue? How does all that come about?
Let's start at the beginning of that equation. I'm 65 years old.
Mm-hmm.
I've written, actually like made a living at it 30 years in a row.
Which is
like
incredible.
Insane, yeah. Right? But it takes a long time for stuff to get made. And I was kind of looking at where I was in my life and going at the rate, because it seems to be like 5 to 7 years for most projects. Sometimes they go faster, but if I were to average them out, and I was going, okay, the next one that happens, maybe I'll have a cane. The next one after that, I'll have a walker. The next one after that, I'll be in my oxygen tent. And I get very tired of waiting for stuff, because I'm writing screenplays. I mean, and a screenplay is the most useless document in the world unless it's getting made. And so, Cindy, the do-it-yourself thing, it became about getting something made. I pitched it once and I heard, oh, it's great, but, and I just said, no, this time I'm not going to hear the but. I'm going to figure out a way to do it myself. I have this very brilliantly talented daughter who is perfect for the role, my daughter Autry.
Mm-hmm.
I've been in the business long enough, my son, where I've seen the whole change that's come when you can do stuff digitally, that you don't have to worry about film stock anymore.
Right.
You don't have these issues that it could actually like stop you from doing something like Cindy. And I just decided it was worth it to take it on and do it. It was one of the best creative decisions and career decisions I've ever made in my life. Yes, it becomes your responsibility, and at times it can feel overwhelming, and at times you go, oh my God, we budgeted for this, but we're $1,000 shy of what we, all that stuff. Those are certain kinds of pressures, but there's also this absolute liberation in doing something that's just really from your heart and your creativity, and you're in charge of it. You're not asking someone, above you, please, please, can I make this, sir?
And yeah, there wasn't a lot of friction as far as you having to direct your daughter or your ex-wife or...
No, I mean, going into it, I was obviously concerned about that. There was a lot of trepidation, but there's something about, unless you're an idiot and you just want to like put the gun to your head and shoot yourself, you leave that stuff at the door. Mm-hmm. And there's an energy that takes over on a good set that heals all wounds.
And you're kind of responsible for setting that tone.
Yeah, and I've directed, the first chance I got to direct was for Tales from the Crypt. I've directed other stuff. I directed another short film. My style of directing is I know what I know. I know what I don't know. I'm willing to ask questions, but I'm really all about building camaraderie and having a fun set, and a set that people really are happy to be there and happy to bring their creative energy to. And if you can, and you usually know that, I mean, the stuff I shoot, I'd love to have more time, but it's all been like 5 to 7 days, in 3 takes, and you move on. And by the end of the second day, you usually know if you've achieved liftoff and the set is coming together. Mm-hmm. And I could feel it. The first day was rough, as first days usually are. But by the end of the second day, I could feel everyone coming together and gelling, and whatever personal issues there were gone. And we were just all in this process together and starting to feel that we were going to do something that was actually going to be good.
What is Cindy about?
Well, Cindy is a modern day Cinderella story. We kind of think of ourselves as the punk rock Cinderella. and it's a story about a Cinderella who has been made the foster child of one of reality TV's biggest superstars, even more hideous Kardashian, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
And Cindy is her foster child / maid servant punching bag. And Cindy is offered a chance to do her own reality show by an aspiring PA who's on the set of of Ray Veen is her name, the reality show TV superstar. He's on the set of her show, and he discovers Cindy and wants to do a reality show with Cindy. And so it's Cinderella within the context of a reality show.
When you're writing something like that, are you thinking of particular actors while you're writing, and that helps to kind of develop the dialogue or the language?
A lot of my success has come from having really good collaborations, and this was one of them. And when you start to be able to weave your voices, you were speaking off air about being a musician. You know exactly what I'm talking about.
Oh yeah.
If you've been in a band or something like that, when you can gel and you can actually weave together, it can be so much more powerful than what you can do on your own. And yeah.
But I also know how challenging it could be.
Yeah.
I mean, I've written lyrics with people where I just want to shoot myself or, you know,
it can happen.
I mean, and especially because writers tend to be pretty to themselves a lot of the time.
Oh no, you know? No. Really? Yeah. Yes.
Tell me about how you make that work. Like if you're entering into a collaboration with somebody, what kinds of things can you do to make sure that it's got the best chance of working?
The main thing that you can do is that you choose wisely, and that you don't say, hey, let's do this together, unless you kind of have a sense of, let me try to say this more simply. It's a blind date. You talk about working together, and there better be, in a creative sense, some kind of chemical attraction, literally, where you think that you can get on the same page together. That was true with Michael McDowell and myself and Beetlejuice. When we came together with Caroline Thompson and I, that was an absolute blind date. The producer Scott Rudin put us together because he thought our sensibilities would mesh. We met the first time here at the Bob's Big Boy, for everyone who's listening around the world, hopefully, is right down the street.
It's a
drive-in restaurant. and we met there for a hamburger and just kind of like felt, okay, we like each other. This, you know, this could work. But then you sit down in the room. There's no way of describing why it works necessarily, but it's just you find yourself being able to create together.
So you were in what is essentially a writer's room with whoever you're collaborating with. And are you just throwing everything out and seeing what happens? And
the three most significant collaborations of my career, Beetlejuice, The Addams Family, and now Cindy, we were literally sharing a computer or both at our computers, sitting nose to nose to each other, writing together. And when it works, now, you said it. I mean, writing, if you can't be alone by yourself, and you're never going to be a writer. I mean, it's the biggest part of the gig in some ways. Mm-hmm. But to be able to sit with someone and pass a keyboard back and forth and feel good about it and feel excited about it. And yes, you butt heads and you get edgy with each other. And I had a classic fight with Michael McDowell about a scene in Beetlejuice. It's one of my favorite scenes in the movie now. But if you can get that energy going with another person, it's great. And it's a refreshing change from sitting by yourself and the only person you answer to is you. Mm-hmm. Which can be both good and lonely and weird and scary and, you know, I mean, and all of that. So right.
So now you threw it out there. I have to ask, what was the scene that you had the argument over?
We had a few, but they always came to a good end. But Alec Baldwin and Gina Davis's character, they die. They're trapped in their house and they need to figure out a way to get to the afterlife to find out what the heck they're supposed to do. And we had, Michael and I had trapped them in the house where it seemed like there was no way out, and we needed to figure a way out, where they could go to the afterlife. And we were what's really sad about this, Phil, is, for a few days, we're taping ourselves on a cassette to kind of remember how the day was going. Mm-hmm. And then it kind of made us self-conscious and we stopped doing it. And I had that cassette in my possession, but I had a house fire and almost all of my Beetlejuice memorabilia burnt up. And that tape was part of it.
Oh, man.
Yeah. And I so wish I had it, because what started happening is that we were just trying to figure out a way to get them out of the house, get them to the afterlife. And I kept throwing out increasingly convoluted ideas about how to get them out of the house. And Michael, which could be his way, go, no. No, no. And I finally said to him, I said, well, what the F do you want us to do? Do you want him just to draw a door? We just started laughing because it was such a perfectly obvious solution. And that's what they ended up doing. They had a piece of chalk and drew a door, and they drew a doorknob on it, and off they went. But I mean, but it was really like a very heated writing day. And I definitely had days with Caroline where we hated each other for half an hour. At Megan, it was a little smoother of a process, but...
When you're writing and not collaborating, when it's just you,
yeah,
will you pass it on to people that you trust before you've decided that it's done, that it's finished, and kind of get feedback?
That's a relatively short list. A lot of times that list is actually, if I'm just writing, if I have a producer already, it's up to me to just kind of hand it over and take my notes and deal with it on that level. When I'm writing something on spec, there's a couple people, and sometimes it changes who they are, who depending on what it is and what the kind of feedback I think I get, that I will hand it off to. But the thing I've learned is that I've got to know for myself, and I've got to believe in it myself, and I need to feel that it's finished. And for that moment, it's as good as I can possibly get it, and not rely on feedback, because that becomes a moving target that can really trip you up.
How much of writing do you think is the inspiration versus the hard work and the editing and the forcing yourself to sit down and all of that?
Well, there's that cliche, what is it? 1% inspiration, 99% perspiration. I'll go back for a second and talk about Michael McDowell, my Beetlejuice collaborator. I had started as a screenwriter. In my mind, I developed in the 80s a very serious case, from a serious to me case of writer's block. But I was in a very unique position because I was a story analyst working around town. I was a union story analyst, and at that time, you would work at every studio in town eventually. And I was at Paramount, and I was doing very well there as a story analyst. A lot of the executives wanted my coverage. And then I got an opportunity from Jeff Katzenberg to start apprenticing for a creative executive job. And I left writing behind and did that. And I became a studio executive for a few years. And I was actually doing well at it, but I really missed writing. But I finally made the decision that I was going to go back and be a writer. And the script that came out of that decision was Beetlejuice. And I went to work with Michael McDowell, and we'd worked together for a week or two. And it was tough love. And I actually, at first I was very offended because he said, Larry, if you're going to work with me, this is not working the way we're doing this right now. Because he said, you're just sitting around waiting for inspiration to strike. And we're not getting anything done. And he said, and Michael at that point had published something like 20 novels. He was prolific, really good, really disciplined, and someone I should listen to, right? You know, and he said, if you're going to work with me, it's going to be like working in a bank. We're going to come in the morning at 9 o'clock. We're going to have our coffee. We're going to go to work. We'll take a break for lunch. We'll come back and we'll write some more. We'll write until 3 or 4, and then we'll stop. And then if we've got phone calls to return, whatever we need to do, we'll do it. But we're going to do that like 5 days a week, or this isn't going to happen. But then he said something to me that was so true. He said, you told me you wrote hundreds and hundreds of pages of notes as a studio executive on other people's scripts. Why can't you write for yourself?
Wow.
Yeah. And I went, wow, exactly. It was one of those moments where you have a shift in perception about yourself and your creativity and all of that. And I said, okay, I'm going to do it his way. I became a professional writer working with Michael on Beetlejuice because that's the way we did it.
Such a great story. Is that really the answer to writer's block in a way? Is just saying...
Yes. I know you know this, Phil. It's all fear-based stuff. That's all it is, that you're not going to be good enough. I had an inferiority complex in some ways because I was a terrible student. I never gone to college. And all these things I sort of thought went with being a writer, I had not done. You start thinking you're not good enough, or you're not writing as well as you wrote the last thing, or you get this mid-career pressure where everyone wants the next Beetlejuice until you think you give it to them. And they go, no, that's not, you know, I mean, and yeah, and you can just, you can grind yourself to a complete stop. The only way, everyone asks what's the secret, and the secret is you just sit down and you just write and something will happen.
So this is another version of that question, I think, or kind of goes a step further. Do you think that there's ever really a corner? Can you ever really write yourself into a corner, or is there always a way out? Like you mentioned with Beetlejuice, you just came up with them, you know, drawing a door and there was the answer. So is it, if you just keep working at it, is there always a way to write yourself out of trouble?
Well, I think that you can write yourself into the corner in the sense that maybe your story has not been set up well enough and you need to go back and revisit that part of it. The reason you will fail is that you will never finish. You will never finish your script. And you will stop in the middle and go, oh, I wrote the wrong one. You know, if I'd only written that other idea, this would really be rocking. I'd be great, you know. And so, yeah, you might write yourself into a corner that you can't get yourself out of. Chances are, if you revisit where you started and the premises that you started on, as long as it's a sound idea and a good idea, you'll figure a way around it. But there's also a lot of times, yes, where you will write yourself into a corner and it may take a couple of days and it may take some false starts and all of that. But something will emerge.
When you come up with an idea, will you outline the whole plot so that you have an ending and you know where you're going to mitigate that situation happening? Or do you like to come up with the idea and let the characters take you where the story's going to go?
The latter. And there's two schools of thought about this. It's a problem sometimes I get in when I teach, because if I'm teaching to a UCLA Extension's curriculum, I should say to you, no, always outline, always work it out. Can I quickly share with you the fallacy of an outline?
Yes, please.
Okay. With it somewhat tongue in cheek, slightly, only slightly. The way that people pitch outlines to you is, if you have an outline, if you have your story completely worked out, when you have bad days where you don't know what to write next, all you have to do is look at your outline and you'll know what to do. Well, the fallacy in that is, who's to say you're not going to have bad days while you're writing your outline, you know, what's the difference, you know?
Yeah.
Well, Stephen King in his book on writing, he's downright contemptuous of outlining. And he is my head and shoulders, my favorite writer, and people who think, oh, he's just a pop, that don't know what they're talking about. He's a brilliant writer.
Yeah.
And he sits down with a premise and, you know, and an idea and a set of characters, and off he goes. It's all about what happens next. And if you keep it that simple, that all you have to do is put your characters in a situation, in a tight spot, then ask what happens next, what happens next, what happens next, what happens next. You eventually come to an end, right?
Yeah.
The brilliant writer of the Game of Thrones books, whose name we should be remembering, but he refers to the difference between a gardener and an architect. An architect is an outline, someone who does an outline and works to a blueprint. And then he's a gardener. And if you've read the Game of Thrones books, they're so complex that you would think that they had to have been outlined. That how could you not, with that weave of characters right. and plot over that amount of time and that vast arena, but he does an outline.
And I feel like that would be a lot more fun.
And there are times that contractually I'm required to outline, you know, I mean, and give them a treatment, which to me is like the most bastardized document in the world. It's not a good story. It's not a good screenplay. It's exists in this sort of this very bland in-between world. But what I find with those is if I'm required to do it, I'll do it. Okay, they sign off on the treatment. Go ahead, you know, write the screenplay. And I will sit down to write the script and the treatment will start falling away immediately because something else will emerge. There'll be some better idea. There'll be some character who rises up in the story that didn't do so in the treatment. Your story becomes less and less like what the treatment was. But by the time you turn in the script, no one remembers the treatment anyway. And if they like the script, they're like, great, you know, right. God, this worked brilliantly.
So it was a ridiculous exercise.
Yeah, in some ways. Yeah. But if you need to do it, you need to do it.
I'm a big believer in this. Learn the, and it was the same thing with music when I went to music school. You learn the rules and then you remember that you can break them and should if there's a reason to.
Yes.
All the time.
Yes.
Right? So there's really no right answer on or no strict rule on how you should write a script.
Yeah. Yeah.
The two things that I want to ask before we wrap up is...
In short form, yes. Yeah.
Is what is your favorite film based on the screenplay? If you can name one, what is your all-time favorite? And then your all-time favorite book that you can recommend that not a ton of people know about?
I am so serious about this, and I so recommend this film, and it changed my life when I was like 8 years old, and I just saw it on a big screen again this last year, and it's absolutely as brilliant as I'm going to say it is, and it's The Bride of Frankenstein. And if you are one of those people who is afraid of black and white, you don't watch black and white movies, shut up. And it is, to me, one of the most perfectly realized gothic horror fairy tales of all time. And everything Beetlejuice for me emerged from my love of that film. And I'm as passionate about it 50 years later, having seen it when I was, you know, on TV when I was like 10 or something, and I'm passionate about it now as I was then. And I could name a million other films, and I love films from all different genres and parts of the world and all of that. But as a touchstone for me, that's it. And if you haven't seen it, watch it. And if you're interested in fantasy and horror, and if you love Beetlejuice, and if you love Edward Scissorhands, and if you love Tim Burton, watch it. It's a touchstone. And I have three books that I always name when people ask me my three favorite novels, and I can tell you why.
Sure.
The first one is Huckleberry Finn by Mark Twain. The second one is A Thousand Years of Solitude by Gabriel Garcia Marquez. And the third one is The Long Goodbye by Raymond Chandler. And the thing I think I love that ties them together probably most distinctly in my mind is they're intensely visual, that they create these incredible worlds that you just immerse yourself in.
Yeah.
You know, the river and Huck Finn, the magical realism of Gabriel Garcia Marquez and LA, you know, the LA noir of Raymond Chandler.
Larry, thank you so much.
I hope I didn't talk too much.
No, this could go on. I can continue. Believe me, there's so much more, but I just don't know how much people are willing to listen to yet.
God, I know, right? Yeah. Well, everyone out there, I'm sorry.
Okay. So listen, you want to learn more about Larry, you want to learn more about Cindy.
Cindy the series.
Yes, Cindy the series. I'm going to put links on the website seatedatthewriterstable.com for you to check out. If you're liking the show, you're liking what you're hearing, please go to iTunes, rate the show for me, leave some comments. All of this stuff, go on Facebook, like the page. All of that matters when we're trying to create a groundswelling and trying to get the word out that this is a place where people can come and discuss writing and get educated about writing. And thank you all for listening very much. This is Seated at the Writer's Table. My name is Phil John Grande, and we will see you next time.